claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. My name is Elise Spenner, and Hannah was not able to join me today for this interview, but do not worry, she'll be back soon enough. It was tragic though, because I now have to read all of the introductions and outros, and sadly for Hannah, I got to ask her favorite first question to our guest today. And I'll tell you a little bit more about our guests, but first, the purpose of this episode is really to dive deeply into the quite confusing factual and legal questions surrounding the affirmative action cases. There was a lot going on, there was a majority opinion, concurrences, dissents, and it wasn't totally clear exactly what the justices decided and how that would work for colleges who are trying to craft admissions processes for students that are applying this fall, students like me. We thought there was no one better to have that conversation with than Professor Richard Ford. He teaches at Stanford Law School and is also a regular contributor at Slate. He also once was a housing policy consultant for Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a commissioner of the San Francisco Housing Authority. He examines both the social and legal implications of racial segregation, discrimination claims, and civil rights. He has written three recent books, Universal Rights Down to Earth, Rights Gone Wrong, How Law Corrupts the Struggle for Equality, and Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. If this bio sounds familiar, we did record an episode with Professor Ford prior to the affirmative action decision, and we thought it would be fantastic to bring him back because he was so knowledgeable and so insightful about really what the core of affirmative action is, how we misunderstand it, and how the end of affirmative action could and now will affect students applying to college and students at college. So this is a really great episode. I learned a ton from it. Professor Ford corrected a lot of places where I had made assumptions or I was wrong, and I'm sure that you will take something valuable away from this episode. So without further ado, Professor Ford, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Yeah, happy to be back. Thanks.
So we recently interviewed Professor Stolberg about the affirmative action decision, and she actually attended Harvard as an undergrad, so we thought it would be interesting to ask her what was Harvard like when you were there, because it was very involved, obviously, in the case. You went to Stanford. How diverse was Stanford when you were there? Was there an ongoing conversation about diversity in higher education? Because it is equally a very selective institution that will be affected by this decision.
Yes, there was certainly a conversation about diversity, and Stanford did have some form of affirmative action policy when I attended. This was in the 1980s. Stanford was much less diverse then than it is now, along just about every dimension. It was less racially diverse and certainly less diverse in terms of socioeconomic status. The idea of a first-gen or first-generation low-income, what we sometimes call FLY students, didn't exist. There was no sense that that was a category that anyone would be concerned about. And so it was a very different institution than it is today.
Do you think there was attention at the time paid to the role of affirmative action in higher education, or was it more seen as something that isn't actually doing very much to change things?
Well, there was attention paid to it. And in one sense, it was much like the conversation around affirmative action today, although less intense. But there were people who believed that affirmative action was important and necessary and thought that the university indeed should do more to promote diversity. And then there were people, as there are today, who felt that the university shouldn't have an affirmative action policy. And those people, some of those people were perfectly happy with the kind of demographics that institutions like Stanford had in the 1960s. And others wouldn't have fallen into that category, but might have felt that, as people do today, the university shouldn't consider race. They should just let in people based on other criteria.
In our earlier conversation, we talked a lot about how you did some early work to highlight and talk about the lost promises of the Civil Rights Act, how we haven't really achieved the full promise of what we sought to do in the aftermath of the 1960s, right? This idea that racial inequality and discrimination are still very much a part of society in America, and especially the education system. How do you think the justices grappled with, or just decided not to grapple with, this history of racism and racial inequality in their opinions?
Yes, this is an ongoing set of questions tied up with affirmative action. The extent to which people believe or are willing to acknowledge that racial bias and systemic racial injustice continues to plague our society. And so both back in the 1980s when I attended Stanford and today, there was a narrative that said, we passed the Civil Rights Act, we've done civil rights, and that's it. And so if there are racial imbalances now, those aren't due to racism because we've already fixed that problem. And so this idea, I believe, carries through to the Supreme Court's majority opinion in the recent affirmative action cases. There's a real unwillingness to grapple with the possibility that a combination of subconscious bias and systemic biases or systemic racism continues to affect decision-making and opportunities in our society, so that Harvard's and the University of North Carolina's admissions policies, in the absence of affirmative action, are channeling that systemic bias. That one way you could look at affirmative action would be to say it's just correcting for the bias that's otherwise kind of baked into the process. I think the color blindness rationale doesn't want to focus on that, or, and this would be the most charitable way to look at it, or they believe that it should be dealt with and that it could be dealt with, let's say, directly. So, I mean, occasionally some of the justices would say, well, if Harvard just quit considering giving preferences for legacies and big donors and the kids of faculty, and they got rid of the athletic preferences, then they could have a racially diverse student body without affirmative action. So one way of reading that is, oh, well, all of those things are the systemic racism. And if they got rid of all those, then you don't need affirmative action. But what no one was willing to grapple with is the possibility that the measures that they considered to be most tied to merit, grades and test scores, also reflected systemic bias. Once you introduce that possibility, the affirmative action policies, I think, look very different.
Right. I think it's almost this idea of nothing can be considered totally equal or in line with a meritocracy, but the justices seem to assume that affirmative action was the most nefarious of the ways that we're making the system unequal, instead of maybe just another way to solve what's already baked into the system.
Right, to take into account what's already baked in. So there's a whole other set of questions about how one would confront systemic racism in the absence of something like affirmative action, whether it's possible to combat race discrimination without considering race, because that seemed to be the position of the majority in these recent cases, that it would be possible to get rid of racism without thinking about the race of individuals who might have suffered that racism, that there was some way to accomplish that, and that that's what the universities ought to do rather than considering race.
I honestly, it's hard for me to totally grapple with this whole opinion that is concerned with the role of racism in society, when the real only compelling reason the court had outlined before for even having affirmative action was this idea of diversity, which is obviously valuable, but isn't about really repairing past harms, right, in terms of the impact of racism and discrimination. How do you think the diversity rationale causes us to ignore how affirmative action is a solution to racism?
Yeah, I think that's right. The one thing that's become more and more clear in recent years is the way the diversity rationale turned into sort of a trap, in the sense that the only legally acceptable reason to have affirmative action after Bakke was diversity, which excluded, for instance, societal discrimination. So Justice Lewis Powell in the Bakke case explicitly said the rationale of remedying societal discrimination was not constitutionally acceptable. It didn't meet the constitutional standard. It was too amorphous. So universities, rather than fighting that, rather than trying to insist that correcting for societal discrimination was a valid goal, they instead retreated, but, well, okay, we can continue to do the same thing anyway, just with a different rationale. We'll talk about diversity. Now, diversity is great. I don't want to suggest that it's not a valid rationale or an important goal. It is. But it did lead to a situation where when someone just talks about the simple equity of affirmative action on both the group basis and the individual basis, it looks like affirmative action is a departure from equity because you've abandoned the rationale that would allow you to see it as a corrective for other types of bias that affect the admissions process. Instead, you're just trying to achieve diversity, which is described as a completely independent goal from the remedial or reparative rationale. And then the question is it okay to have something that's unfair to individuals in order to get to diversity? Now, once it's framed that way, the answer doesn't look very good for affirmative action. You know, diversity better be really important if it's going to justify something that's unfair, that doesn't take into account individual merit, that discriminates against other racial groups. And so in this latest case, the court essentially said, although they did so in a way that was a little bit opaque and ambiguous, but essentially said, you know, diversity is not good enough to justify that.
Yeah, I think it's almost the starting point of saying something is unfair is really, really hard for people to wrap their minds around that being acceptable and okay. I think because we just have such an obsession with fairness that assuming from the start that affirmative action is unfair makes it really, really hard, I think, for the justices to rule that it's constitutional.
Right. It makes it very hard to defend.
And then talking about the diversity rationale, because I equally picked up on that being really weird that the justices all of a sudden said that this was no longer a coherent interest, that it might have been great. We all want diversity, but it wasn't sufficient for the purposes of strict scrutiny. How did you see them toe that line in terms of, yes, diversity might be important, but not important enough?
Well, it's interesting because they never actually explicitly said that, at least not in the majority opinion. Instead, they implied it. But what the majority opinion actually said was, we're not overruling Brockie. We're not overruling Grutter. Instead, we are simply saying that what Harvard and the University of North Carolina did failed to meet the existing legal standard. And then there was a lot of talk about how Harvard and the University of North Carolina were focusing too obsessively on race, race per se, as opposed to experiences that attached to individuals, a lot of language like that. But what was never really clear was, where does the diversity rationale fall within this analysis? Interestingly enough, they didn't attack that. It was only in concurring opinions that you had a full-throated attack on diversity. But those concurring opinions, it's important to note, aren't the law. They didn't command a majority of the Supreme Court. So what you have in this is kind of just, this is a little bit of a geeky lawyer's take on this, but it's worth noting that you've got a majority opinion, which is the only opinion that counts as law, that doesn't overrule Bakke and Grutter, that says the universities can continue to consider race as part of individual applications, but it can't consider race kind of in the abstract. It's not really clear, but what is clear is what Harvard and the University of North Carolina did isn't okay. But then you have a lot of concurring opinions that give a much more aggressive critique, diversity of the idea of affirmative action generally. And it's hard to know what to make of all that when those concurring opinions didn't command a majority of the court.
Right. And it seems like the court is, in some senses, splitting hairs when they're saying Harvard and UNC can't do what they're doing, but we're not overruling Bakke and Grutter, which just said you can use race as a plus factor, which in many respects might be what Harvard and UNC are doing. Why was the court so frustrated with Harvard and UNC's policies? I was a little confused about exactly what the factual record was and what the justices actually found so problematic about how these schools were considering race.
Right. Well, it's not surprising you were confused about what the factual record was, because the majority opinion really played a little fast and loose with the factual record. So at times they cited the factual record of the trial court, and at other times they speculated in ways that were just inconsistent with the factual record. So it was very hard to track as a matter of normal appellate decision-making. The appellate court should be bound by the factual record at trial, but the Supreme Court does whatever it wants. And so there were moments where they went off on wild tangents, speculating about what Harvard must have thought or must have considered that wasn't in the record. So trying to figure out what exactly is wrong with Harvard and UNC's policy is trickier than it seems. On the one hand, there's a kind of gestalt, if you will, from the majority opinion combined with the concurrences that, again, the majority didn't join, but that gives you the feeling that they really dislike affirmative action generally, that they think it violates the Constitution, that colorblindness is the new norm, diversity is dead. And so that's an easy takeaway. But when you actually look at what the opinion says, the one that got a majority to join it, it doesn't say that. Instead, it looks a lot more like what the court had done in previous affirmative action cases, where they narrowed the scope of acceptable affirmative action, but continued to allow affirmative action as constitutional. So when you really look at the holding, it looks a lot more like Grutter and like Fisher versus Texas, where each time the court would say, we want to be very strict about when the universities can do this. We have a lot of requirements for when they can consider race. They have to overcome strict scrutiny, but they can still do it. And here at the end of the majority opinion, the court says, nothing in this opinion prohibits the universities from considering race as part of an applicant's profile. So one way, if you just read that, the operative holding of the majority opinion in isolation from everything else, you would say, okay, this is another case where they're narrowing affirmative action a little bit, but no big headline here. But when you read the parts of the majority opinion that are what we lawyers call dicta, meaning they're not law and they're not necessary to the holding, but they're the opinions of the court. When you read the concurrence, you get this gestalt that, okay, they're really overruling Bakke and Grutter and they're really repudiating affirmative action. So it's a strange opinion. And I expect that one of the things that's going on is that the justices don't agree. So I suspect that the people who wanted to overrule affirmative action, it's quite clear that Clarence Thomas did. It's fairly clear that Neil Gorsuch did, although his concurrence was about a quite narrow legal issue. I'm quite certain John Roberts did, given his past opinions. And I would say the same about Samuel Alito. So you probably had four votes on the court to just overrule Bakke and Grutter, repudiate affirmative action, but they needed five. And I'm guessing, but my guess is that they couldn't get five. Brett Kavanaugh, who wrote a concurrence saying we're not overruling Bakke and Grutter, so it's pretty clear what he thought. The other vote would have been Amy Coney Barrett. So I suspect that those two justices didn't agree. And as a result, in order to cobble together a majority, you had to have an opinion that was ambiguous on a lot of points. The Chief Justice wanted to overrule affirmative action, but he didn't have the votes for that. So in the end, you wound up with something that kind of sounds like it's overruling Bakke and Grutter, but really doesn't.
Which just seems so confusing, especially for colleges that are trying to figure this out in a few months in terms of what should our policies look like in a way that's going to be constitutional. I'm applying to college this fall. And I've gotten so many emails from colleges saying we're still as committed to diversity as we were before. Mm-hmm. And you would think they know they can't do what Harvard and UNC were doing.
Right.
But perhaps is there a middle ground? Is every single college going to have to bring their affirmative action policy to the Supreme Court? That seems pretty untenable.
Right. I think that there is going to be a lot of confusion. I suspect that the reactions to this opinion will be quite varied. That some universities will say they're really repudiating affirmative action. We need to be careful and safe, and we better not do anything that might get us sued by an opponent of affirmative action. But other universities might say, and I think this would be the right thing to do just based on the law, let's read the majority opinion and see what it actually tells us. That's the law, the rest isn't. And the majority opinion tells us we can still consider race. The majority opinion tells us we can't do whatever Harvard did, so okay, we won't copy Harvard. And it seems to suggest that there's a problem with checking a box about race, having an applicant check a box, and then putting weight on that. So I expect universities will want to avoid that. But that's different than reading an application that includes a discussion about the person's experience in a racial community or with racial injustice or racial bias, and considering that. And what's quite ambiguous in the Supreme Court's opinion is how one distinguishes those two. In other words, distinguishes considering race per se from considering an experience with racism, an experience in a racial community, racial pride, all of these other things that really are part of an individual's personality. And in one sense, aren't easy to distinguish from non-racial communities and experiences of other applicants.
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this in our other interview, but it would there would be serious free speech problems with trying to tell someone they can't write about race in their essay when they're totally allowed to write about culture or the struggle they face, whatever it is, that why is race singled out as something you can't write about? So I think it was obvious that Roberts and his majority had to leave that wiggle room for people to write about race in their essays. But I'm almost confused. Are universities going to use that as a proxy for not being able to check the box?
Right. And that's what Chief Justice John Roberts says you can't do. So as he says, you can still consider race, he says, but you can't do it in order to reproduce the kinds of policies that we've repudiated here. But this begs the question, exactly what are the features of the policies that you're prohibiting that we're not supposed to reproduce? That's not quite answered, but it does seem that there's a complicated question about when it would be the case that the university, in considering an applicant's personal statement about their experience, is using that as a proxy for race, which would seem to violate the law, or conversely, whether race is a proxy for those experiences, which seems like a pretty good definition of what affirmative action has always been. The reason the universities consider and care about race is because they think it's a proxy for some set of experiences in a society that's characterized by racial divisions. That seems like a pretty reasonable assumption. And so in one sense, when you look at the opinion based on its actual operative language, you could say that the Supreme Court is simply saying you may not use race as a proxy for experiences with racism, racial communities, racial divisions. You have to look at those directly. So you're going to need some other evidence that the candidate has those experiences. You can't assume that based on their race alone.
That's such an interesting way of thinking about it, because really that's what diversity is about at the end of the day, is just getting a ton of different experiences in a classroom. Perhaps the simplest way to do that was understanding that diversity in terms of race will inherently bring diversity in terms of experience. But the court saying you can't be so general.
Right. You can't assume that. Now, I would point out that in one sense, for the university admissions officer, this makes things very difficult and very ambiguous. Because one could say that every aspect of the admissions criterion are proxies for something else. If you look at grades and test scores, they're a proxy for academic promise or hard work or something along those lines. If you look at the fact that the person played sports in high school at a high level, that's a proxy for athletic ability that's going to contribute to the university setting. And at the same time, race is a proxy for the experiences that the university is looking for. At some level, we're always looking at proxies. And so now we're just quibbling about which ones and whether or not race as a proxy for racial experiences is a reasonable one. It seems really weird to say that it's not. But what one thing that the court did was try to almost deconstruct the idea of race by saying, for instance, the university's categories don't consider divisions within racial groups. So if you think about Latinx, what about all of the different Latin American countries that the candidates might come from? Shouldn't the university care about each one of those? Now, of course, the answer is they do, but the court used that in order to attack the idea of thinking about race. Very often you'd hear people talk about wealthy African-Americans or even wealthy Africans who, you know, well, should they receive an admissions preference when they're the lead in an African country and coming through? So those ideas are what's evoked in order to say it's not okay to look at race. I'm not convinced that universities were actually that crude in their use of race to begin with. Perhaps they were, but some of this seems to be saying you can't do that. You need to have a better and more refined idea of why you care about race. That's going to be time-consuming and costly for universities, but in theory, they could do it.
You're right. The big problem the court seemed to have, and that a lot of people have seemed to have with affirmative action, is that it lumps people together and it reaffirms stereotypes, not just for African-Americans, but also for other racial groups in terms of assuming what they're going to bring to a campus because of their race. And I think a lot of people would look at like the conversations between Harvard admissions officers as proof that they were engaging in this type of stereotyping. Do you think that is a valid outlook?
I don't think it's a valid attack on affirmative action. However, it wouldn't surprise me at all to hear that stereotypes sometimes play a role in a selective decision-making process. I think that that is a widespread phenomenon in all kinds of decision-making processes, from hiring processes and the employers to certainly higher education is not immune from the kinds of racial stereotypes and subconscious racial biases that are in our society. So yeah, but it seems to me that the affirmative action is probably the least problematic example of this. So if you go back to the evidence in the Harvard case, for instance, where there was a complaint, and Samuel Alito made a lot of this during oral arguments, that the Asian American candidates got, as a group, lower scores on things like likability in the subjective evaluations. Now, that is evidence, not proof, but evidence of racial bias. And that's not affirmative action. The affirmative action policy is a separate thing. You've got subjective decision-making, which presumably schools are going to engage in regardless of whether they have affirmative action. And does subjective decision-making often include or become a gateway to widespread societal biases? Yes, it definitely does. It does for all groups. So that doesn't surprise me. So the difficulty then you have is that that's being lumped together with affirmative action when the plaintiffs bring a discrimination case against the universities. The plaintiffs can certainly prove that the universities are considering race because they admit that they're considering race, part of affirmative action. What they can't prove is that there's subjective bias in the other parts of the decision-making process. They have a little evidence for it, but it's not enough to meet the burden of proof. So now you've got all that lumped together. And so I would argue that a lot of the evidence for stereotyping comes from practices that aren't affirmative action, but it's being used in order to say that affirmative action is guilty of stereotyping.
So almost like there's no way to totally prove these subjective biases, so we use them as evidence of this broader conspiracy that people opposed to affirmative action call affirmative action. Do you think universities will be able to continue to achieve the same level of diversity they have in their schools at the moment in the absence of affirmative action? And do you think the court would be okay with that?
I don't think they'll be able to achieve the same levels of diversity. All of the evidence suggests that in the absence of affirmative action, the amount of racial diversity diminishes. And yet, I do think that they'll be able to achieve more diversity than one might expect if from a process, for instance, that only considered grades and test scores, and a good deal more. And the experience of the University of California is illustrative in this respect, that over the years, the University of California has done a lot of work in order to refine its admissions criterion to produce diversity. Now, I would view that as an effort to eliminate the other types of systemic and structural biases that were holding down the number of underrepresented groups. That's a lot of work, but it can be done. And as a consequence, they've come a long way. So yeah, but it's not easy given the limited resources that universities have. So drilling down to individual stories is really time consuming. Getting rid of the standardized test because it has a racial impact that may not be justified. Universities can do that. And for instance, the University of California is doing that. That's very expensive though, because now you have a much broader pool of applicants that look plausible in the absence of the standardized test than if you use the standardized test to rank them. So it creates a lot of practical problems. And I think everyone's aware of that. The admissions process will never be perfect. You know, if you could imagine, should we have affirmative action or should we have a perfect admissions process that considers every aspect of it? You know, of course, we should have the perfect process, but we can't achieve the perfect process. And so everything the university does is imperfect and produces some unwanted skews in the admitted class. Affirmative action is one way to correct for that. And in the absence of that, the universities need to work a lot harder to get closer to that perfect process. But I don't think they can get there.
Right. And I think this is exemplary of the court being a little bit divorced from the actual realities of what it's like to be working in higher education and being an admissions officer. I think they almost pretend like we can achieve that perfect admissions process in the absence of affirmative action. You can't just immediately say schools are going to be able to create a fair system without affirmative action or have the resources for it, or if it's even possible.
No, I think that's right, that some things in the majority opinion and some of the concurrences were very disparaging of universities and university admissions officers. Yeah. They acted as if they were lying, they're dishonest, they only care about optics, they're lazy, all these things. And I, in my limited experience with university admissions officers, think that none of those things are true, that what you've got are a group of dedicated professionals that are working very hard to meet a lot of conflicting goals of the university. And failing to take that into account just isn't in touch with reality. Now, honestly, I have to say that at least some of the members of the Supreme Court, you have to understand this very well. I mean, these are smart people, but they have taken the position that as a matter of principle, the university can't consider race and we just don't care what the outcome is. Now, they deny that at some points, but at other points, it seems very clear that they say whatever the outcome, you can't consider race. And understanding that all of these other issues in the admissions process still exist. But I do think there's some that probably really deny the existence of systemic racism. And so for those people, if the number of certain racial groups is very low, they don't care. We don't know why, but that's not our problem.
Yeah, it's shocking. And I think it's interesting to think about how differently the justices, even in the majority, view the combination of the role of systemic racism and the role of affirmative action in combating it. They're definitely not a monolith in terms of their outlook on that.
No, I think that's right. Now, I do think that one of the implications of the colorblindness idea of equal protection is that the law doesn't reach systemic racism. And so some of the people who advance that view believe or claim to believe that systemic racism doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. Others, I think, might acknowledge that systemic racism exists, but say we can't do anything about it. And so that's just going to be something that we live with. And then, of course, there are those in the dissent who put a great deal of emphasis on the prevalence of systemic racism and the need for some policy in order to confront it. So I think you've got positions, as you say, the court's not a monolith, but the thing that joins the opponents of affirmative action is either the belief that there's no systemic racism, or if there is, it's not the appropriate role of the university to try to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's a really good clarification. In terms of just another thing I'm thinking about, we talked about the UCs as kind of a model, not an ideal model in any sense, but of what universities could do in the aftermath of affirmative action. Do the UCs take that approach of looking at how an individual talks about race in their essays? Is that something they can do or do? Do you know?
I don't know the details of the UC's policies. I do know that they spent a lot of time thinking about diversity issues, but the details are kept pretty close to the vest, in large part, I think, because there's a real worry that applicants will try to game the system, that whatever they're considering, once people find out about that, they're going to try to make it look like they have that criterion, and that undermines the admissions process. And so I'm not certain how the UCs understand their obligations under the California Constitution, which prohibits considering race with respect to admissions essays. I did hear that right after Prop 209 was passed, there were people who at least argued that the essays should be redacted so that racial information wouldn't appear. But I don't think that's currently the policy. For reasons that you mentioned, I mean, it's got First Amendment problems, and it's a real imbalance between someone whose important informative experiences involve race and someone whose important and informative experiences don't really involve race, that the person with the racial experiences is put at a real disadvantage at that point by saying you can't even talk about them or you can't consider them.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. But even if the UC model might be more extreme than what the Supreme Court requires in terms of being race blind, that might be what most universities default to, or something similar, just because they're worried about lawsuits, worried about getting caught in the litigation that Harvard's caught in.
Yeah, that is possible. I hope that's not the case, since it's not what the law requires. But I do imagine that some people will read this in the gestalt of the opinion to push them in the direction of strict colorblindness. And in that sense, the UCs, I suspect, will be a model, and that a lot of people will want to study very closely how the UCs have achieved the amount of diversity they have.
What do you think of the potential, not solution, but alternative that's been floated in terms of using socioeconomic status, not as a proxy for race, but as an alternative way to increase diversity? I think I saw a lot of essays, even before the affirmative action decision came out, that said this would be a far more helpful way to increase diversity than race.
Well, all the evidence demonstrates that that's not an effective way to achieve racial diversity. Having said that, I think it's a laudable project in its own right. I absolutely think that universities should do more with respect to looking to members of underprivileged groups in general, without regard to race, people of lower socioeconomic status, first generation. They've started to do that in recent years. I think there's more to be done in that respect, and that's a great idea. But it's not a substitute for race-based affirmative action because the racial disadvantages are distinct from the disadvantages of socioeconomic status. They overlap in many cases, but not all cases, but they're also distinct because we still live in a society with a lot of racism and with the legacy of quite explicit state-sponsored racism. And that's a different phenomenon. And a lot of people want to collapse those and say, oh, if they're poor because they're Black or they're poor because they're Latino, then if we just focus on the poverty, problem solved. But it's not just that.
I also know that a lot of people have, obviously, just as the court did, brought up the concerns of legacy admission, of giving higher admit rates to people that have parents who donated or et cetera, athletic interest. And I even had a friend come up to me the other day who she has legacy at a school. And she said, I don't know if I'm going to apply there anymore. I bet they're not going to consider legacy. I was kind of like, they can keep considering legacy all they want for the time being. Do you expect that to change in any way? And is there a legally enforceable reason why schools wouldn't be able to use legacy anymore?
I think there's a lot of pressure on things like legacy admissions. And that's the one that's raised most often. And other admissions criteria that have a racial impact that disadvantages members of underrepresented groups. Having said that, universities have good reasons to want to consider things like legacy and donor preferences. Now, they're not reasons that sound in the register of fairness to individual applicants, but they are reasons that are respectable in terms of the university's overall mission. So if the university needs to establish intergenerational continuity in order to carry on traditions and in order to get people to be excited about the university and donate, and these are in many cases private institutions that rely on donations, all of that is reasonable. It's not fair to the individual applicant in terms of a measure of individual merit, but it is reasonable. Similarly, if a university wants to have a sailing team or a crew team, they need to recruit athletes who know how to sail or who know how to row crew. Now, all of these things can be questioned, and I think that universities who are really committed to diversity will begin to ask themselves, what's the trade-off between what we're getting from these other admissions criteria and what we're losing in terms of diversity, whereas before they could kind of make up for it with affirmative action. In terms of the legal arguments, it's not clear, but there is a legal argument that admissions policies that have a disparate impact violate the law, that they violate Title VI, which is the legal statute that governs private universities and through which historically the equal protection standard has been applied to private universities. But it also governs public universities. It governs all universities that receive federal funding. Indeed, a complaint has been filed with the Department of Education asserting that legacy preferences violate Title VI. I'm not so sure that it's a strong case. Historically, this has not been found to violate Title VI, and these policies have been around for a long time. And in addition, the enforcement mechanism is a complaint to the Department of Education. So the Department of Education needs to take that up. It has to make an independent decision that this violates the law. Now, maybe it will. Justice Biden said a few things that suggested maybe he would support Department of Education looking into some of these other policies. But historically, that hasn't happened. And there's no avenue for an independent lawsuit by individuals. So unlike what's going on in the affirmative action context, the what's called disparate impact, that's the body of law that would make this unlawful, that doesn't give rise to a private cause of action. All of that's a little bit more detailed, perhaps, than you needed. But I wanted to explain why it is that although there's a legal argument, it's probably less likely to be a successful legal argument than one might imagine.
And maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but the disparate impact argument seems to be a little extreme to me in terms of, is it just if the admit rate is higher for a certain racial group, that is a disparate impact?
Yes. I mean, that's the shorthand version of it, but The second part of the analysis is that the policy is only unlawful if it's unjustified. So that what's unlawful is an unjustified disparate impact. And what makes the policy potentially justified is whether it meets some legitimate institutional goal. Now, one way of thinking about this is, for instance, the SAT has a racial impact. Is it unlawful under Title VI? Well, no one's thought so up to now. The reason is because most people have assumed that it's justified. It measures something that the university is legitimately concerned about, academic promise. Now, legacy admissions, they're on a little wobblier footing in terms of being justified, but the university could certainly make an argument. As a private institution, we are entitled to prefer alumni, to prefer repeat customers, if you will, to prefer people that we think are more likely to contribute to the university in a variety of ways, including financially. Any other nonprofit does this. You know, we wouldn't look askance at a theater company that gave first priority to tickets to big donors to the theater company before they opened the gates to the general public. And so those get into some complicated legal arguments that have never been tested because this theory hasn't been brought before.
So it's all a bit hazy and ambiguous.
That's a bit hazy. I wouldn't put my money on the plaintiffs winning this disparate impact claim, but I think it looks more likely today than it ever has in the past that such a claim could succeed.
And honestly, that universities, especially the ones that in the past have seemed the most concerned about diversity, might actually take the step themselves to end legacy admissions.
Yes, honestly, I think that's more likely than a successful Department of Education complaint. That the universities, I'm certain, are looking at all of these criteria very carefully, and they may, if not eliminate, at least reduce the weight that's given to some of the criterion that are having a disparate impact.
Yeah, totally. I think that's interesting. It's that like they don't need to completely do away with legacy admissions. It plays an outsized role from what I know in admissions, and they could lessen that. What do you see as the best possible scenario? What would you say is the best way that higher education as an institution could respond to the end of affirmative action?
Well, I would say, first of all, look at the majority opinion in the Harvard and North Carolina cases very carefully and don't overreact. Don't read things into the opinion that aren't there. Don't respond to the gestalt of the opinion or things that are written between the lines. The law is not between the lines. It needs to be clearly stated. And what's clearly stated is certainly a limitation on affirmative action, but it's not a repudiation of affirmative action. It's not a repudiation of the diversity rationale. So starting with that, then I would hope that universities would look very carefully at all of their admissions policies to identify criteria that have a disparate impact on underrepresented groups and ask hard questions about whether or not that impact is justified. And that would include everything from high school grades and test scores. How good a proxy are they for academic promise? There's a great deal of debate about that. Many people argue that they're a better proxy for socioeconomic status than anything else. That's a problem. So those could be examined. There's nothing preventing that. Legacy admissions, certain types of athletic recruitment, which give rise to very substantial admissions preferences, much greater than anything that comes from race and affirmative action. All of those could be re-examined. And I think if all of that happened, that would be the optimal situation. Even with all of that, I think we'll see a drop in the amount of diversity. But I think that drop could be much less dramatic than a lot of people fear.
And to clarify, so universities will no longer be able to look at what box an applicant checked in terms of their race. And are universities even going to be able to see that? I guess, are they going to be able to consider it at all?
I don't think there's a legal basis for saying that the universities can't see it. However, I do think that a litigation-averse university might say we don't want to see it because that will then be evidence against us in a potential lawsuit. We'd rather not see it. So you're already seeing that I believe the Common App is giving universities the option to not see that information on the applications, that it'll just be redacted before the university receives the applications. So I expect you'll see some universities doing that. And then there was a lot in the majority opinion about specific practices, like after they'd gotten a first kind of rough cut they would look at the racial breakdown. And the court thought that was a problem. So maybe that's a practice that universities will decide is no longer acceptable. We can still have the same admissions criterion, but we can't check and make sure that we get a reasonable racial balance. I mean, I think that's too bad, but that's one implication that one could reasonably draw from the majority opinion.
Right. What I remember reading in the opinion was that if at first what you're doing is, okay, you take a group of people that you think you could reasonably see at your school, right? And then after that, you look at race as a factor in whether they're going to be admitted from that group of highly admittable candidates, which schools cannot do now, I think is easy to say.
Right. It appears that they can't do that and that they really need to be careful about any kind of checking on the numbers, which came up often. So those are the things that it appears that they look to the Supreme Court like considering race per se and might get you into legal trouble.
What do you think it's important for students who are either entering college or who are applying to college in the coming years to think about and to know, especially if they're worried about the future of campus diversity and what their school might look like?
Yeah, I think that a few things for students who may feel that this means they're no longer welcome. And this is something that you heard a lot after Prop 209 in California, that Prop 209 passed and a lot of the Black and Latino applicants said, oh, we might as well not even bother because they just said they don't want us. I really hope people don't feel that. Most universities are, as you say, still committed to diversity. They really want these applicants. They may not have affirmative action, but that doesn't mean that they are not actively desired by the universities in question. That's one. Other thing is that I do think university admissions are going to change pretty dramatically. And it's hard to tell how this is all going to settle down. So a lot of the old assumptions that people were working on based on past years are probably out the window. You just don't know, for instance, how much weight they're going to put on something like legacy status, like what the athletic recruitment is going to look like. How much weight are they going to put on test? Are they going to go test blind? What does that mean? All of that's in flux now. So I suppose my biggest piece of advice would be to continue to focus on the things that the individual applicant's passionate about and not worry too much about trying to work the admissions process. Because even if that was a good idea in the past, it's a really bad idea now, given how unpredictable it is.
Totally. That's great advice as someone that's applying to college. And I know for my peers would certainly value that. But thank you so much for joining us. Your insight is always, always appreciated. And I love getting into the really legal side of it, even if some of our listeners might not value it as much. But I appreciate you breaking it down.
Sure thing. Well, I was happy to be here. Of course, I count on you to edit it so that it meets the target audience.
Of course, totally will. Thank you again.
Take care. Bye.
Wow, that was a fantastic conversation. I felt like I learned something every single second. Professor Ford just looks at things from an angle that no one else is looking at them and dives deeper. He dives really deeply into what actually did the court decide and how will it play out on the ground. When a lot of people are making overbroad statements about the decision when they haven't actually read it, Professor Ford has, and he makes sure that we all can understand it in an accessible and easy way. So I'm so grateful that he came on the podcast, just an invaluable resource. We will be producing at least one more episode on the affirmative action case and breaking down the rest of the term for you, as well as previewing potential cases that could have a huge impact next term. So stay with us. We are so, so, so lucky to be able to record this type of episode for you on a weekly basis. In the meantime, leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars, everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. I can't wait to see you next time, but with Hannah as well.